So we have Shantanu's class here this evening. Thank you all for coming. What class? This is college?
This is at San Jose State, and the class is The Roots of Contemporary Buddhism. Hmm. So we have been doing, up until now, actually, mostly concentrating on Theravada Buddhism, formation of the Sangha.
Hmm.
We just started with Mahayana Buddhism two weeks ago before the spring break.
Hmm.
And talked about Bodhidharma and the stories that Zen tradition likes to tell about its origins and the historical veracity, or not, of Bodhidharma and the flower, the silent servant story.
Hmm.
And we will, from now on, concentrate mostly on forms of Buddhism in the States, mostly San Francisco region. Alan Watts, Shunryu Suzuki, Paul Karun is not from San Francisco, but the beginnings of the Buddhist tradition in this country.
Great. Well, wow, you all have quite a grounding and background in these teachings already, it sounds like. And a good place in the class, it seems like, the transition from Zen and the origins of Zen in China and Japan to American Buddhism, because we're sitting right at that transition ourselves. So many things could be said, right, about Zen. And you, I think you all came to Zazen instruction earlier with Patrick. And so you heard some about the meditation practice, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, because that's really the root of Zen. The main event of Zen Buddhism is Zazen. As you probably know, the word Zen means meditation. And this hall here is set up with these platforms and cushions just for this purpose of sitting Zen. And I'll try not to talk too long, because it'd be nice to have a discussion. And I'm sure you have questions about the practice that we do here and so on. So some of this may be familiar, and some of it maybe have been covered in Zazen instruction, but here's another version of Zen for now. In our school of Soto Zen, coming from Dogen Zenji, a founder in 13th century Japan, our style of sitting meditation is presented by Dogen in many different ways and treatises, but one of his most popular and earliest writing he wrote is the Universal Recommendation for Zazen, for sitting meditation. The Fukan Zazengi, which we sometimes chant. And when Dogen came back from China, he felt like people didn't really understand what Zazen really was in Japan, so he wrote this treatise to clarify the practice. And so it starts out by saying, Dogen starts this treatise on the recommendation for Zazen, and particularly the recommendation for the style or manners of Zazen. Fukan Zazen Gi. The Gi means you could even say a ritual or manners or style of Zazen. But he starts off, I think, quite beautifully and importantly by saying the way, the Tao, the way that's, that Buddhism incorporated this term, the way, from Taoist teaching, meaning like the way things are. There's a lot we could say about the Tao and the way, but the way everything is working together harmoniously all the time. So Dogen says the way is originally perfect, complete, and all-pervading. And that's basically his Zazen instruction. He goes on from there, but that's the main point. The main instruction, really, we could say. And recommendation for sitting meditation. I practiced at a Zen monastery in Japan for a while, and they have these carved wooden signs with calligraphy, kind of poetic calligraphy and quotes from Zen teachers, you know, hung around the temple. And over the door to the meditation hall, to the Zendo, like this room, there was this giant carved wooden sign that in with the Chinese characters for the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. And I thought it was significant that that's where it was placed, is in the Zen hall, the entrance to the Zen hall. So it was more kind of like when you enter the hall and you're kind of maybe forgetting why you're going in there or what the practice is that you're going to do in there. That's the basic instruction. And I felt very moving. It was a huge sign, as big as me, that stepping through the door, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. Okay, now we're going into the room of the room where the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. Of course, it's everywhere, but this is the room where we're going to actually remember that and live that. And then Dogen goes on in this treatise to speak in this manner a little bit more, in this very, you know, wonderful way, to these statements that are like, if we could really take in what he's saying, it's very, very good news. Right? The way is originally perfect, complete, all-pervading. And he says, how could it be contingent on practice and realization? How could this all-pervading way depend on our little practice and our realization? It's not only seems silly to say that it would be dependent on our practice, but it doesn't even depend on our realization of it. It's all-pervading, complete from the beginning, originally. The school's vehicle is free and untrammeled, Dogen says. What need is there for concentrated effort? The whole body, the complete reality, is far beyond the world's dust. So how could we have a means to, you know, brush it clean? It's beyond dust. So we hear that and we think, wow, great. And then Dogen says, and yet, and yet, if there's the slightest discrepancy, the way the Tao is as distant as heaven from earth. And, well, what is the discrepancy? Any veering off from this teaching that the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. If there's the slightest discrepancy, any kind of discrepancy. But then the next sentence is, if the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So the way is originally perfect, and it's all-pervading, means it includes everything, so therefore it must include likes and dislikes and everything else. And yet, if the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. Of course, the originally perfect way includes the mind lost in confusion, too. But yeah, the mind is lost in confusion. And so we don't appreciate the this perfect way. So it's like these two sides. First he brings up the essential point, the essential instructions, to just remember that the way is the complete harmony of everything, can't be defiled, can't be disturbed in any way. And yet, if our human mind well, the way he puts it is arises as, you know, likes and dislikes, we're totally distracted and confused from this perfect way. So isn't this the case? This perfection, and yet we're totally confused very easily. And maybe most of the time we forget how perfect and complete things are. So these two sides. And because you've been studying these Buddhist teachings, you maybe have some sense of how the way in the Tao could be perfect and all-pervading. Now, in some ways, in Theravada Buddhism, this side is not so emphasized. It's more like all conditioned things are suffering and impermanent, and our whole life is just samsara, and it's driven cyclic existence. So that's part of the shift to Mahayana. There's many aspects of this shift from Theravada Buddhism to Mahayana, but one shift seems to be this positive outlook. You can find it there in Theravada, of course, too, but the emphasis in Theravada is on, let's really look closely at our confused and defiled mind, which is very valuable to do. It's like, let's be really ruthlessly honest with ourselves and really look at that. So Buddha's teachings are really emphasize all the different types of afflicted mind states so that we can be free of them. It's not totally negative, right? It's about nirvana also. It's about the cessation of all these defiled mind states. And yet the emphasis is so much on the defilements. And Mahayana, especially as it met Taoism, Chinese culture, it kind of meshed with this more beautiful view of what some people might call samsara, that actually everything's in perfect harmony. And like, let's remember that. Let's remember the positive side and be encouraged by that. Let's be realistic too. So Dogen says, yet if the least like or dislike arises, the mind's lost in confusion, but let's remember the positive. And he starts his Zazen instructions with this, the positive side. And this sign over the Zendo didn't say, you people are totally deluded, get over it. It could have said that, and probably there are some Zendo signs that do say this. But it's about deeply trusting and opening to this originally perfect, complete, all-pervading, harmonious, inconceivable way that's, you know, drifting through the door and emanating from the birds' mouths as the sun sets into the ocean, and all of that, no problem there. And also in this view of the Tao, the human world with all its troubles and sickness and death, and all of that is perfectly harmonious from the perspective of the way. So it's remembering that, deeply, deeply trusting that at the beginning. And then Zazen, the sitting meditation, we could say, is just sustaining that view of the way. It's one way to talk about Zazen. We hear about the all-pervading, perfect way, and then we sit down, and in Zazen instruction, you got all these postural tips, and there's specific instructions of sitting upright and so on, in the midst of the all-pervading way. And then, although Dogen says later in this treatise, Zazen doesn't depend on sitting or lying down or walking or any particular posture. And yet, we say, for now, just tentatively, at the time we call Zazen, formally speaking, we take this posture, this upright posture, and we stop all our activity, and we don't move, and we just relax and breathe in the present. And then we could say that the practice is just sustaining this view of the way being perfect and all-pervading. Sustaining that view, being in accord with such a view. We put our body like this, and what do we? And our breath relax, and the mind. Well, what do we do with the mind? The various techniques, but basically, one way to talk about what to do with the mind is just sustain this view in a way that's, you know, we don't have to think about even. The way is we just trust that the way is perfect and all-pervading, and then we just accord with that. And another way to talk about according with that view is not doing anything about anything. If the way is basically perfect and all-pervading, any attempt to mentally, in this case, because we're sitting still, we're not physically doing anything, and we're not verbally doing anything, but with the mind, we don't do anything about the way things are. Which may be a strange way of talking, but actually, if we examine our mind, it often is attempting to do something about the way things are. Like it's like and dislike, for example. Like and dislike arising is kind of like is a little bit like preferring certain parts of the way over others. The way is originally perfect, all-pervading, and so it doesn't have better or worse aspects. So if likes arise, then it's kind of like, well, I prefer this part of the way over this part. And dislikes, well, I'd rather the way wasn't quite like this. So that's when the mind is lost in confusion, it loses the way. And of course, it doesn't really lose the way by definition, because the way is all-pervading. And yet, Dogen says the mind is lost in confusion. So then we could say that, you know, a technique would be when likes or dislikes arise, just relax and let them go and return to the present. That's more like a, sounds more like a practical instruction. But that's just another way of saying, just according with the perfect way. And you might have heard in Zazen instruction different things we sometimes do, like the breath is a following the breath, counting the breath is a helpful tool to just return to the present where everything is just the way it is. But the point of Zazen is not to follow the breath. It's just a tool we can use, but we don't even need to really use. It's just that if our mind is really out of accord with the way, seems to be out of accord with the way. If we're really caught up in likes and dislikes, mind, past and future, thinking mind, then it's helpful to have some remedial kind of technique. Like, okay, let's just, the breath is just present and naturally happening. And the breath is actually in accord with the way. So just, let's just breathe. But if we're, if the mind is more settled, we maybe don't even need to do anything in particular, except just be here in accord with the way, and just, we notice when we're not. Or that's the, hopefully, we can notice when we start to get involved in thinking that the way should be different than it is. And so it helps to understand and trust that the way is just as it is and can't be different. Can't be different in this moment. And in the next moment, it must be different. It's continuous change itself. But it's not a matter of our control. So really, just being is zazen. Just being here, now, present, in harmony with the way everything is. And beyond our ideas of what that is, you know, if we it's a little bit like extra to even think like, oh, okay, let's see, now I'm in harmony with the way. Yeah, it's like this. You know, that those very thoughts are a little bit like adding something extra to the way. I mean, they are part of the way, and yet they're to be most wholly in accord with the way, we don't even have the thought that we're in accord with the way. Just like the bird singing is, you know, is not thinking, oh yeah, this song is in accord with the way. It's just, that's why it's so, nature is so beautiful. It doesn't think that it's out of accord or in accord. It's just manifesting such accord. So this kind of meditation is kind of different than the early Theravada meditations. Kind of different and not so different also. Like you may have heard about the foundations of mindfulness. Be mindful of body, feelings, mental states, and teachings about the way things are. So that's just like a more elaborated way of saying the same thing. Mindfulness is actually just present awareness of what's happening. So present awareness is another way to say zazen is just present awareness, but it's not something that's not already happening. We are presently aware. And then later in Dogen's instructions, in his zazen instructions, he says, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. This is not an issue. It's not a matter of being really smart and trying to figure out how all this works. And maybe that's obvious that that's true, right? It's just like the way is just the way. You don't have to, I mean, there's many, many pages and pages of teachings in Zen describing the practice and the way, and yet it's very, very simple also, right? It's just the way everything is arising and ceasing moment to moment, just like this. So intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and the sharp-witted, there's no distinction. And then Dogen says, if you concentrate your efforts single-mindedly, that in itself is the wholehearted practice of the way. So earlier he said, it's not a matter of concentrated effort. So So at this point, he's saying, if you concentrate your effort wholeheartedly, that's just being in accord with the way. So we could say these, to resolve that contradiction, we could say, well, at first he was talking about making an effort, striving towards some future way that we're not right now. And the effort, the wholehearted effort that's in accord with the way, is just, as Suzuki Roshi, our founder in America, said something like, right effort is just the effort to, I think he maybe says, get rid of something extra. We could say the effort to just not add anything extra. So the wholehearted effort to just be here, present, and not not think, well, isn't there something more than that? Or doesn't it get better than this? Or, you know, this can't be Buddha's enlightenment, so I better do something else. So not, so it's that wholehearted effort to not add anything extra, like such thoughts, or the wholehearted effort to just really be here, really, really open to the present awareness. Which sounds very simple, but if any of you have meditated, you know, we're just constantly veering off the present. So some people might agree and some might disagree, but if we say that Zazen is just being present, some people might say, well, that's part of it. You need to be present, but you also need to like understand such and such or whatever. But that's a proposal to in a very practice or experiential kind of way, to just in your own experience to actually see if you are just completely being present. Is there any delusion? Can there be any delusion in the complete present? I'm not saying yes or no, but it's an interesting thing to check out in your own experience. Do we need a kind of past or future, even just a little bit of past and future, in order for there to be deluded or even dualistic thought? So, when Dogen says, it's wholehearted, just to concentrate your effort wholeheartedly, whether or not you are dull or sharp-witted, that is the wholehearted practice of the way. And then he says, going forward in practice is a matter of, sometimes we say, everydayness, or another translation would be ordinariness. And we've been talking some about this Zen phrase, ordinary mind is the way. And Dogen is actually pulling that story up in his instructions. He's constantly quoting these old Chinese stories, and so he's playing out with that story. Going forward in practice is a matter of ordinary mind, we could say. Everydayness. And in Zen, as the Chinese ancestors defined the term ordinary mind, it's the mind free from any grasping or rejecting. The mind that's just being here, present, not doing anything about anything. Very simple, but very challenging, actually, to be so ordinary. We're not, We're usually involved in trying to add something extra or subtract something. So that's a in kind of a Zazen instruction in Dogen style. It's really like Zazen is really not actually doing anything at all. Yet we have this posture, we have these details of the posture, and we have all these forms and ritual ways of doing things, as you probably were shown. And yet that's all just a ritual celebration of the all-pervading perfect way. Zazen itself, the sitting upright in a specific posture and not moving, is in the early tradition was usually seen as it's a means to an end. It's conducive to good energy circulation in the body to sit upright, and it's yoga, it's physical yoga and breath yoga, and it is that. But the Zen perspective is more like this is just a ritual kind of enactment of the way being complete, where nothing needs to be done. So particularly not moving and not doing anything and yet not falling asleep or getting distracted or thinking about other things, just being wholeheartedly and presently and alertly just in accord with the way things are, with no manipulation, is a kind of ritual enactment of accord with the way. And we're already in accord, we can't be out of accord, yet to take such a posture is like celebrating this accord really, really wholeheartedly. For example, doing something, doing anything about anything, is a little bit like resisting the way things are. We, at least at the time of Zazen, we very literally and completely just practiced not doing anything about anything. For example, just not moving, just like. Wanting to move the body a little bit is kind of like wanting to the unmoving present way is not quite okay. We should adjust it a little bit, but just like nothing needs to move here. And with the mind too, nothing needs to move into the past or the future. It's just flowing in the present naturally. So it's a little bit of Zazen instruction from Dogen. So if you all have questions about the practice of Zazen or anything else about the Zen tradition, please feel free to bring it up. Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to thank you very much for hosting.
Oh, you're welcome.
There are a couple of things that I like pick your brains about, whatever that idiom is. So this course is a hinge. It is a transition point between talking about, we've mostly talked about the Theravada tradition, the issue of suffering, the issue of desire, the nature of desire, speculation about and meditation on the nature of desire, the control, the wayward mind, and the control of the wayward mind, and mm-hmm. It's not just about self-control; it's also about self-abandonment, as you were saying, to ordinariness.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's in a way that's quite similar to say, the desire for something other than what's happening right now it's kind of like it's not full appreciation of the way. So
one of the things that I want this class to get out of this course is understanding the nature, not just nature of not just self-control, but self-abandonment, and in particular, self-abandonment using art, using our physical beings, using beauty as a way of creating both focus and control and self-abandonment and all of that.
By self-abandonment, you mean like letting go of the separate self?
Or being open to what, you know, other religious traditions might call an epiphany. So to that end, we will be discussing, having discussed mind control and desire, nature, investigation of the nature of desire and all of that, we will now be moving to what Theravada monks in India and Sri Lanka have done besides meditation. They have been involved in the use of images and the use of relics. And we'll be looking at Tantric Tibetan tradition, which is also quite involved with the visuals of living mandalas. And that we are physical beings, we are visual beings. And so look, we'll end the course by going to the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, looking at both Buddhist art and its antecedents in, you know, in Hindu art. So can you talk a little bit about the use of not just mind control and nature investigation, you know, speculation about desire, and but also, you know, the use of images, the use of material, visual, physical culture. And if this is a little unfair of me to ask you, but there are other Japanese traditions, Shingon, for example, and Kobudaishi, they use mandalas also, that are less stare than Zen, more, I don't know, folk. And in America, we sort of tend to think of Mahayana Buddhism as sort of Zen being, you know, it looms very large in our imaginations. Whereas in the Japanese experience or the Tibetan experience, there are other traditions which are more, I mean, this is beautiful in the way that a Protestant church is, but there are other aesthetics.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that? Could you talk about the Buddhist engagement with the physical world and not just thinking and thought?
And you know, as you probably know, Zen has greatly influenced the whole aesthetic in Japan in particular, maybe more than China. There's this whole realm of Zen arts and physical activities. The whole Japanese culture is infused with particular artistic expressions that are greatly influenced by Zen practice and understanding. And so we have things like tea ceremony and flower arranging and calligraphy and brush painting, and so just in the Zen realm, the visual is definitely an expression of kind of Zen understanding of the way things are. Like, it's a lot about spontaneity. I'm thinking particularly, just to take for example the classic visual thing of calligraphy and brush painting and so on. And it's very much in contrast to, when you look at Buddhist art, very different from the Tibetan and Shingon mandalas, which are very highly structured and very carefully done, very symmetrical and detailed. Zen art, you know, traditionally, the part that really became known as Zen art is this, it's expressing something about how the way demonstrated by nature and everything else is like outside of human control, which also is related to self-abandonment, I think you could say. It's actually, like you say, early Buddhism almost looks like it's about controlling through discipline the person, whereas in order to overcome our defilements. Whereas Zen, in some ways, we could almost say it's like the opposite. It's like letting go of all control, because we see that our controlling tendencies are actually cause us so much suffering. We're trying to be somebody in particular. We're trying to like fix up our problems all the time, which it makes them much worse. So it's a kind of a tricky thing, but to actually let go of self-control, in it, you know, we have to understand what that means. But that's one way to look at Zen meditation. It's framed in the posture and particular ways what we could call control the posture. But then the mind within that framework is just lets go of all manipulation and control. And then that's demonstrated in like these art forms where there's like a big white paper and just like one big stroke across, you know, or something in the corner and the rest is just left white, and it's not symmetrical and it often doesn't look so neat. And some of these, you know, Zen artists, they look like little kids drew the pictures. I mean, they're really, they have this childlike quality sometimes. And it's just about spontaneous expression in the moment and without judgment. So they can have these childlike pictures and they'll say, that's not good enough. Just like, that's it, that's what happened. The way manifested like that. Big mess. And there it is, it's art. And flower arranging too, it's like, it's not like a perfectly symmetrical thing. It might be like just one, you know, a flower over here and then one giant stalk sticking out over here. And like, that's weird. It kind of strikes us. But it's more like the way nature actually is. It's not, it's uncontrived. And So that's one demonstration of like this Zen mind that's just the natural way, or we could say, going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness or ordinariness. Ordinary, it's very ordinary art. It's very unrefined compared to a lot of art. And ordinary here actually means free from, you know, ordinary as ordinary mind is the mind free from grasping and rejecting. So that art that's free from like grasping and rejecting, trying to make good art or art that's a certain way, it just comes out the way it comes out. So it's unusual movement.
What about the use of relics? I know that Zen Buddhists don't have stupas, mm-hmm. but you do have reliquaries. And mm-hmm. this is an issue that we'll be discussing a lot. Mm-hmm. The use of relics and the stupa as a focus of devotion, some, approaching something like bhakti within Hinduism.
Yeah, and there are stupas in Zen. Mm-hmm.
Are those actual mm-hmm. domed?
Yeah, they're usually not domed. They're more like these, like a natural rock, for example, or very simple like wooden post.
Or a reliquary. Mm.
And sometimes, and then they'll put ashes yeah. and relics of teachers
books,
sometimes under them, but they're much less elaborate, like most things in Zen, mm-hmm. than other traditions, stupas. But stupa represents the actual, like the Dharma body, the true nature body of a great practitioner who's no longer here in the physical body. So it's a representation and reminder of their true, vast, inconceivable body in a form.
If I may, for example, in our garden here, mm-hmm. that tree that is blooming, that double cherry tree, mm-hmm. was actually planted in memory and in ceremony and ritual for Komenchino Roshi, who started this place 30 years ago.
So it's a living relic.
Yeah, and we, as a Sangha, one of our Dharma brothers died in the little house right next door about, I don't know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And people from the community took care of him, mm-hmm. even after the point of where he died. And going downtown and getting ice from the liquor store to ice the body and sit with him. And the little pine tree that you were all walking on the patio, some of his ashes are there. So I think that part of the, I mean, I don't know about if it's Zen or not, but my experience of, you know, the kind of living practice is that there's an aspect that's maybe not so much about this art form over there, but this integration, or like when you said the rock, you know, I thought, yeah, that really, that's a Zen stupa, the rocks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean...
And I think also we express, so we do have physical forms, and there's this, I think Zen is very aware of the danger of like a reification of like if, and Dogen at one point does talk a little bit about, apparently there was some student of Dogen who was really into worshipping relics and had this box of relics that he always like prayed over, and Dogen said, you should be careful about this. And I think what he was, basically, if don't get distracted from the all-pervading original way that's, you know, doesn't have any form at all.
I just wanted to ask my class, do you know what I mean by a relic? It's a container for ashes or books or sandals or the begging bowl used by either the historical Buddha or various masters. So what you're saying is that there's a living reliquary right here.
I wouldn't have called it that, but as I'm listening to the two of you talking, I just wanted to acknowledge that in the, you know, kind of the community of practitioners.
And there's also
like that's the direction that we go.
I was talking more about human-made reliquaries, which are not, I mean, they're not living physical objects, but it's the presence of the Buddha or Dogen or Bodhidharma or teachers within the physical remains. He is present, or she is present within the physical form of the relic.
Also, we have a Zen story about one teacher saying, after I die, build me a seamless reliquary or a seamless stupa. And it became one of the Zen koans, and there was more dialogue about that. But he seems to be pointing to let my stupa have no edges, no demarcations. So that's kind of the, you could say that's a representative Zen story about stupas, is build me a seamless stupa. And yet there are actually physical sometimes, and I think that just brings up, you could say, it's a devotional thing. And Zen practice definitely has a devotional side, like we do chanting and we make offerings.
Can I ask one more thing around Shiva?
Yeah.
So what is the American Zen take on devotionalism? Not the Japanese or the Tibetan, but modern post-50s or 20th century American Zen take on devotionalism.
Well, it's hard to say what the whole realm of American Zen, because there's all different takes, but I would say in general, I would say there's less emphasis in American Zen on devotion than there is in Asian Zen and Asian Buddhism.
So this is an issue that we will be discussing.
Yeah, and I think it's because when Zen first came, other forms of Buddhism too, but Zen in particular is already a little bit less emphasizing devotional practices. So, and people like, I think it caught on really big because it's like, it's not even really a religion. It's just being, right? It's just according with the all-pervading way. People heard those teachings and like, yeah, and you can be any religion and do that, and you don't need any particular devotion. And yet, I think as time goes on in American Zen, we're bringing in more and more traditional devotional elements, and people are appreciating that more and more. I feel like in American Zen, and seeing how it's not something extra. I think this is, maybe it was good that in Asian Zen they maybe start with the devotion, and maybe some people never hear about the all-pervading way. Mm-hmm. It's just a devotional practice to make merit or something. Whereas here we start with the all-pervading way, and then we're like, and then how can we express it in all different ways and more fully? Well, let's do some art, and let's make offerings to express, not in order to improve anything, ideally, but just to accord with and honor what already is. Something like that.
Thank you.
Yes.
I just want to add to that. Mm. You know, we do have a ceremony every month, I believe. We have all kinds of ceremonies, you know. There's a ceremony every month honoring Suzuki Moshi. Mm-hmm. There is...
every morning we dedicate, we chant and dedicate to Suzuki Roshi.
Yeah.
So.
There are these ceremonies of gratitude over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And to all the Buddhists and ancestors, and the chants, I think, are all very devotional. Mm-hmm. And our bowing practice, mm-hmm, is bowing, you know, to the way and to each other and to all of those who have come before us as an expression of our devotion.
Definitely.
Gratitude. And, you know, as far as rocks go, when, if you've never been to Tassajara, which I encourage all of you to go, there we have, you know, a wonderful way of that you climb a path, and at the top of it, there is an enormous rock that actually students of Suzuki Roshi hauled up from the creek when he was still alive, I believe, even. And there are some of his ashes, and also, remind me.
Katagiri Roshi?
Yes, Katagiri Roshi and Tibet. Trungpa Rinpoche. And so, you know, there are many ways that you have of expressing devotion.
I'm partly an insider to this group, and I do come here to meditate. But for the purposes of this class, I have to ask questions from the outside.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah. And also, when I say, you know, I think we do have a lot of that. But if you look at, like, you know, if we compare even what we do ritually or devotionally compared to Japanese, if you look at, like, the zazen versus ceremony ratio, in America, I'd say, like, it's, you know, the zazen to ceremony ratio is 4-1, and in Japan it's like 1-4.
Okay. So this is an issue that I would like you to mark, because Greg Chopin and Don Lopez are both going to be talking about this particular issue with the use of images and our bodies, and how different Buddhist groups have had different, you know, perspectives on this. I will shut up now. Any questions from the
comments? It's actually, it's about time to stop the formal talk, but if people can come in for tea, we can keep talking, and I'd be interested to hear what you all say. And I think it's great that you're having this class and you're going through all these different kinds of Buddhism. And this is just, you know, it's moving to me, because I was in college when I first heard, but I took a Zen class, and here I am now, right? So I really appreciated that that time in my life when first hearing about these teachings, and how it really struck me, and that it's, you can study it and you can practice and live it also, and make it your whole, have it infuse your whole life. And so I just, anyone who feels that spark of wanting to take it up more, there's infinite opportunities to.
Well, I did want you to see this space. I think this is an amazing space. I'm moved every time I come in here. So here you are. And if you can stay for the tea, that would be great. Questions you have for Kokyu?
Thanks for coming, and you're welcome to come practice here anytime.
SCZC.org.
We dedicate the merit of this gathering to the complete, perfect accord with the all-pervading way for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless, I bow to say.